Hello, this is Greg Witt with Alpenwild. Regardless of whether this is your first time in Zermatt or if you've been here dozens of times, there are some fascinating and new discoveries you'll encounter on our tour today. We'll start in the Bahnhofplatz, just outside the Zermatt train station. If you're already there, great. Otherwise, pause the audio for a moment, go to the Bahnhofplatz, and we'll get started. Welcome to Zermatt, one of my favorite places on Earth. As you arrive in Zermatt and survey the setting, with scores of shops, restaurants, and hotels, many crawling up the mountain slopes on both sides of the valley, it's difficult to imagine that Zermatt was once a sleepy alpine hamlet, not much different from what you would still find today in many of the adjoining valleys in this Swiss canton of Valais. With the Matterhorn as a backdrop, and such an abundance of skiable and hikeable terrain all around, I think Zermatt was destined to be a world-famous mountain resort at a very early age. Today, Zermatt has a resident population of about 5,800 people, but it has nearly 15,000 hotel beds, so clearly tourism is the lifeblood of Zermatt. But what I'd like to do is peel back some of the modern layers, skip the trendy shops, bypass the big hotels, ignore the towering cranes that signal more building and more expansion, and discover what Zermatt was like 100, 200, even 1,000 years ago. Until the mid-19th century, Zermatt was an unnoticed agricultural community. Then, all of that changed with the first and tragic ascent of the Matterhorn in 1865, but more about that later. The car-free village of Zermatt is located at the end of the Mattertal, at an elevation of 5,315 feet. It's surrounded by some of the highest peaks in the Alps. Let's take a minute right now to get oriented and become familiar with the setting. If you're standing in the Bahnhofplatz, just outside the Matterhorn-Gotthardbahn train station where you arrived, and facing south toward the Matterhorn, you'll notice another train station on your left. This is the Gornergratbahn station, where trains depart throughout the day to the Gornergrat, where you'll have spectacular views of the Matterhorn, reflected in small lakes, as well as the Gorner Glacier, and dozens of other 4,000-meter peaks. Now, as you face south towards the Matterhorn, there's a string of major peaks that form the Swiss-Italian border. You know the Matterhorn, but scanning the summits to the left of the Matterhorn are the peaks of Breithorn, Pollux, Castor, Liskam, and Monte Rosa, which at 15,203 feet is the highest peak in Switzerland and the second highest in the Alps. The mountains to your left are known as the Mischabel Alps, and while you really can't see the peaks from the valley floor, you'll have a much better view from the Gornergrat. The Mischabel Range features some of the legendary alpine summits, including Dom, which is the highest peak, lying entirely within Switzerland. Now that you have your bearings, let's walk up Bahnhofstrasse, through the commercial center of Zermatt, to the Hotel Post on the left and Grampy's Bar on the right. Pause the audio now, and we'll resume when you reach Grampy's and the Hotel Post. Right now, you should be standing on the main street of Zermatt, with the Hotel Post on your left and Grampy's on your right. From the corner on which Grampy's is located, take the steep, narrow lane that rises up to the right or west. Our destination is the English Church. As you're walking up to the English Church, about 80 meters up the lane and to your right, let me tell you a bit about the early history of Zermatt. Human artifacts, including stone axe blades found on the Theodol Pass and shelters found on Schwarzsee, evidence human habitation going back over 8,000 years. Roman coins found on the Theodol Pass, that's the saddle between the Matterhorn and the Breithorn, which is now a popular ski area, show that Zermatt was part of a trade route and a military highway for Gaul and Helvetia between 200 and 400 BC. 100 years after the birth of Christ, the people of Zermatt lived in scattered peasant houses clustered around what is today the heart of the town. Zermatt is first mentioned in written documents dating to 1280 under the name of Pratoborno, which means meadow by the spring or source, which is considered a reference to the glacial cirque and water sources at the head of the valley. With the Valser migrations and the influx of Germanic-speaking peoples into Alpine valleys in the 12th and 13th centuries, the Latin name was Germanized to Zermattu, meaning at the meadow, which eventually became Zermatt. Today, Zermatt is the southernmost German-speaking town in Europe. Throughout much of the Middle Ages, Zermatt consisted of about 100 houses and was under the ecclesiastical jurisdiction of the Bishop of Sion, who transferred or leased his rights to various barons or feudal lords. It wasn't until 1546 that Zermatt was able to free itself from the ecclesiastical tutelage of the St. Nicholas Parish, the village down the valley with the Onion Dome Church, which you certainly passed on your way to Zermatt. The people of Zermatt actually saved up and bought their freedom with money, paying for it in old Swiss currency called Mercerpfund. Now the tables have turned, and it's the tourists who are buying their freedom with money. Today, the currency of choice is the Swiss franc. By now, you should be at or near St. Peter's English Church. This church dates to 1871 and is actually older than the Catholic Church in Zermatt. The English Church, designed in the Neo-Gothic style of the period, was built as a memorial to the Reverend Charles Hudson, who fell to his death on the first ascent of the Matterhorn. His remains are entombed in the altar wall of this church, and the bodies of other English climbers who lost their lives are buried here in the church's cemetery. So how did an English church wind up in a tiny Swiss village? Well, in the early 19th century, it was fashionable for English schoolboys to spend a year on the continent as a way of finishing their education, sort of a precursor of the gap year that's popular today. Since there are more 4,000-meter summits surrounding Zermatt than any place else in Europe, Zermatt became a mecca for Englishmen with a passion for climbing mountains. And Zermatt's history has always been intertwined with the Matterhorn, the other 4,000-meter peaks in the area, and the legendary climbers from the golden age of Alpine mountaineering. Now let's descend back to Bahnhofstrasse and Grampy's, where we began this little side tour. Pause the audio, and we'll resume when you get back to Grampy's on Bahnhofstrasse. Now you should be back on the main street of Zermatt. Let's continue walking up Bahnhofstrasse to the Hotel Monte Rosa, about 50 meters up the street and on your right. In the early 19th century, tourism started to take root in Zermatt as people came from throughout Europe to see the Matterhorn. In 1838, Vicar Rudin encouraged a local surgeon, Dr. Joseph Lauber, to open the first inn. That modest inn had 3 beds and was called the Hotel Chavannes. In 1854, Lauber's inn was purchased by Alexander Seiler, who added 35 beds and renamed it the Hotel Monte Rosa. Seiler launched a hotel dynasty, including the Monte Cervin Palace, the Victoria, and the Riffelalp, which retains a stately presence in and around Zermatt today. By 1865, when Edward Whymper, a young English engraver with a penchant for mountaineering, arrived in Zermatt, he would have had several choices for lodging, but he stayed where some of the other English climbers were staying, at the Hotel Monte Rosa. The Hotel Monte Rosa is still the headquarters of the British Alpine Club. Now, standing in front of the Hotel Monte Rosa, locate the plaque honoring Edward Whymper, while I share with you the details surrounding the first descent of the Matterhorn. Of the many 4,000-meter peaks surrounding Zermatt, the first to be climbed was the Breithorn in 1813. It's considered the most easily climbed 4,000-meter peak, and even an inexperienced mountaineer can climb it in a few hours, starting at the Kleine Matterhorn tram station. As most of the other surrounding peaks were climbed in the 1830s to 1850s, intense competition developed in the pursuit to conquer the Matterhorn, which for many years had been considered unclimbable. Much was at stake. If climbed first from the Italian side, the bragging rights, the world renown, the carriage trade, and continued tourism revenue would go to the town of Brioule, Italy. But if the first ascent were made from the Swiss side, the glory would go to Zermatt. Edward Whymper had already made several failed attempts from the Italian side along the Lion Ridge, which at first glance looks easier than the Hörnli Ridge, which faces Zermatt. Then, in 1865, Whymper learned that the Reverend Charles Hudson, a respected Alpine climber, was in Zermatt with intentions of climbing the Matterhorn. Whymper, crossing over the Theodore Pass with Lord Francis Douglas, joined forces with Hudson, George Hadow, and guides Michel Croz from Chamonix and Peter Tugwalder and his son from Zermatt. The plaque on the Hotel Monte Rosa states that Whymper set forth from the hotel on July 14, 1865. Actually, it was on July 13, 1865, but making corrections in cast bronze is difficult. Then on the 14th, ascending the Hörnli Ridge, the party of seven arrived in the summit area, with Croz and Whymper reaching the top first. Whymper recorded, "The slope eased off, and Croz and I, dashing away, ran a neck-and-neck race, which ended in a dead heat. At 1:40 p.m., the world was at our feet, and the Matterhorn was conquered. Hurrah! Not a footstep could be seen." As they looked down the Italian side of the mountain, they saw Jean-Antoine Carrel, Whymper's former guide, about 400 meters below the summit, climbing the most difficult section of the route. They called out to get Carrel's attention and even started throwing and rolling stones off the summit, not a particularly smart thing to do. Eventually, Carrel saw his rival on the summit, gave up on his attempt, and returned to Italy. Whymper and his party spent about an hour on the summit, and then began their descent with the seven climbers roped together. However, during the descent, just below the summit on the north face, the inexperienced Hadow lost his footing. In less than 3 seconds, Hadow fell onto the unprepared Croz and pulled Hudson and Douglas away from the face of the mountain. Peter Tugwalder Sr. wrapped the rope around the rock, but it snapped, and four of the seven climbers fell thousands of feet to their death down the north wall of the Matterhorn. Whymper and the Tugwalders returned to Zermatt, bearing news of both the triumph and the tragedy. As the news flashed around the world, Zermatt and the Matterhorn became enshrined in mountaineering history and in public memory. Now, let's continue up Bahnhofstrasse toward the church. But first, make note of the Matterhorn Museum down the stairs and to your left. This museum has a very modern appearance from the outside, with its exterior of glass and chrome. But once inside, you'll enter the world of Zermatt as a 19th century village, presented as an archaeological dig. The museum beautifully captures the way of life in a small Alpine village 200 years ago. It also traces the history of mountaineering on the Matterhorn. There are a number of multimedia presentations running throughout the day. You'll be able to see the frayed and broken rope used in the first ascent and one of Hadow's shoes. It's well worth visiting. It takes about an hour, and you can stop now or plan your return for later, but do make a point of going. Now, let's continue up to Zermatt's Catholic Church on the left. After Zermatt purchased its independence and was no longer under the tutelage of the parish in St. Nicholas down the valley, a church consecrated to St. Maurice was built here around 1575. If the name St. Maurice doesn't ring a bell, He's also known as St. Maurice, St. Mauritius, and in eastern Switzerland, he goes by the name St. Moritz and has a well-known ski resort named in his honor. St. Maurice was a black Christian from Egypt and the leader of the Roman Legion, serving in an area just down the valley near Martigny in the 3rd century AD. According to the story, Maurice's legion, composed entirely of Christians, was called by Emperor Maximian to defeat a revolt. However, when Maximian ordered them to harass some local Christians, they refused, and Maximian ordered the legion punished. Every 10th soldier was killed in a military punishment known as a decimation. More orders followed. They still refused, and a second decimation was carried out. Finally, because Maurice refused to use violence against fellow Christians, Maximian ordered all 6,666 remaining members of the legion executed. So it's easy to understand why St. Maurice is a venerated martyr in southern Switzerland. Even though a church has been on this site since 1575, the growth of Zermatt required building a new, larger church. The church you see today was built in 1913, with a design that was intended to recapture the Baroque artistry of the previous church. Let's go inside the church. You can pause the audio briefly if you wish, and resume once inside the church. Now that you're inside the church, let's face the main altar of the church, where you'll see statues of Saints Maurice, Urbain, Martin, Joseph, and Ignatius. These works date to 1750. The right lateral altar, with statues of the Holy Family and evangelists Matthew and John, dates to 1720. Now look above and notice that the ceiling, painted by Parente, is a more modern treatment. This church has a wonderful organ, and free concerts are offered on a regular basis. Check the schedule posted on the front of the church for concerts, recitals, and other events open to the public. In addition to the chapel you're in, there are a number of other small Baroque chapels in the area, including Blatten, dating to 1604, Findeln, 1691, Winkelmotten, 1609, and Schmutt, 1797. If you visit some of these villages during your stay in Zermatt, which I hope you do, you'll notice some similar Baroque styles, but on a much smaller scale. Now we're going to visit the cemetery behind the church and on the southeast side of the building. Pause the audio and resume when you're in the church cemetery. You should now be standing in the small cemetery directly behind the church. Let's take some time to wander around the cemetery, paying special attention to the number of individuals who lost their lives while climbing the nearby peaks. Now, work your way to the back of the cemetery and look for a square pillar of gray stone about 1 meter high. This is the tomb of Michel Croz, the Chamonix guide who led the first ascent on the Matterhorn and perished on the descent. In a kind of tombstone shorthand, it reads, "To the memory of Michel Auguste Croz, born in Tours in the Valley of Chamonix, we regret the death of a brave man, a devoted friend to his companions, esteemed by travelers. He perished not far from here, a man of stout heart and a faithful guide." Next to the grave of Croz is the grave of Haddow, and a tombstone also includes mention of Lord Douglas, although his body was never found and remains trapped forever below the icy north face of the Matterhorn. You'll also see the graves of Peter Taugwalder, father and son, who, with Edward Whymper, returned safely to Zermatt. Now, leaving the cemetery, cross the street, and in a short jog to your left, walk down a side street to the north for about 150 meters. You'll have a park and a community cemetery on your right-hand side and the back of the Zermatterhof Grand Hotel on your left. You pass by homes, small garden plots, and come to a small intersection of three streets and a fountain with a plaque honoring one of Zermatt's great mountaineers. Pause the audio and resume when you reach the fountain. You should now be standing in front of a small trough-shaped fountain. This fountain and plaque honor Ulrich Interbinnen, a Zermatt mountain guide famous for his long career and his love of the mountains. Ulrich climbed the Matterhorn over 370 times. Then, on the occasion of the 125th anniversary of the first climb of the Matterhorn, Ulrich climbed the Matterhorn at the age of 90. This climb was broadcast live on Swiss television. Ulrich later died in 2004 at the age of 103. Now let's turn to your left and walk up Hinterdorfstrasse, the narrow cobblestone street with the old timber buildings on both sides. As you walk up the street, take some time to read the interpretive signs on each building and feel free to take photographs. Let me point out a couple items of interest. First, you'll note that many of the buildings are set on pillars on top of large stone discs. The purpose of these discs was to keep rats and mice from getting into the storehouse. This feature was common, especially for a granary or a storehouse. Keep in mind, the Black Death or bubonic plague that swept through Europe in the 14th century killed more than 25 million people, over a third of the European population. That devastation was still fresh in the minds of Europeans, who went to great lengths not only to protect their hard-earned grain harvest, but to control the rodents that carried the disease. The stones were very effective in keeping rats out of the granary. Next, you may notice on your right a burlap sack hanging from one of the posts. It may have a sign that says brot or bread. Rather than throwing away stale bread, neighbors would put it in this sack, which would then be given to the pigs or chickens as feed. Even today, you'll see people walk by and place their old bread in these sacks, and you may want to do the same. We'll conclude our tour right here in the historic heart of Old Zermatt by giving you a capsule timeline of how Zermatt quickly grew, gained fame, and attracted tourists following the first ascent of the Matterhorn in 1865. 8 years later, Zermatt was connected to the Morse Telegraph Network, and in 1878, Mark Twain came to Zermatt and wrote his comic story, Climbing the Riffelberg. The first train station arrived in Zermatt in 1891 and ensured a steady stream of visitors from then on. Just 7 years later, in 1898, the Gornergrat Bahn went into operation, taking visitors into a glacial paradise. But Zermatt was still primarily a summer resort until the first ski lift was built in 1942. Within 2 years, for the first time, Zermatt had more guests in winter than in summer. Today, Zermatt is a year-round resort with hundreds of hotels and restaurants and hosting millions of visitors annually. Still, at its root, Zermatt is a quaint mountain village, steeped in tradition and closely connected to the land. You don't have to walk outside the village for more than a few minutes to see that agricultural way of life still preserved. So please, do get out on foot and explore the hills and villages around Zermatt. You'll be richly rewarded. Thank you for joining us in Zermatt. When you get home, be sure to visit us at alpenwild.com. Tell us about your experience in the Swiss Alps. We look forward to your joining us in the future in any of our favorite alpine destinations. This is Greg Witt for Alpenwild. See you on the trail.